Get ready for poems for people who hate poetry.
On this episode, we will be covering Jordan Peterson's Rule 8. Tell the truth, or at least don't lie. In his 12 Rules of Life, an antidote to chaos. Now, to tell you the truth, I've been a little critical of the last few rules of Jordan Peterson. Rule 5, don't let your children do anything that would make you dislike them. I've been very critical on, that's the one that really started it off for me, I think. Mainly because I think he's focusing on socializing the child. And so I spoke my truth, even though I really like him and I want to be liked by people who like him. But I was honest about my disagreements with him to the best of my abilities. And, that's important. And the same thing is true of the 6th chapter, which is really dove into for me. It was one of the chapters I dove in the most to because I was interested in Columbine. And that was the rule 6, set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. And again, the rule itself is not so much what I have a disagreement with. I am definitely an advocate as a person of ordering your own, what I would call inner kingdom, or being rational and thinking about and chewing your own ideas and your own thoughts that you have before you go out there Bible thumping and going after everybody and attacking them and all that. I agree with what he's saying. Set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. But I disagree with many of the baseline arguments he was making about that rule. And, you could see chapter 5, where I have the disagreements in my podcast on chapter 5 and my podcast on rule 6. And same thing with pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient. Again, I do agree with that, but I had some severe disagreements with his predominantly Christian argument and viewpoint on that. In this one, tell the truth or at least don't lie, I think he does a splendid job of the principle of honesty. I agree with this principle, the way he breaks it down. I think he focuses more on other people than I have in my training with Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand's a virtue of honesty, which she says is the simplest of all the virtues in the sense of once you understand her master virtue, which is the virtue of rationality, which is to always adhere to the reality, essentially, and focus on the facts of reality, and then use your conscious reasoning mind, rationality, to come to conclusions and always be sharpening the saw or questioning and improving your ideas as long as you live. And honesty is just a particular reflection of the rule of rationality. And that's, again, to focus on the facts of reality and never try to deceive those facts, not to yourself primarily. And her focus is what it does to you. Now, Peterson also focuses on what it does to you psychologically. And that's why he's good. That's why it's great. But he also gives some good examples of why it's bad to lie to other people, not just for yourself, which I think is a great understanding of the principle. On the other side, not only is it bad to lie, does it harm your psychology? And we're going to get into that. And we're going to talk about also and read through a cute little poem called The Sin of Omission. But there's a practical benefit that he talks about. He doesn't, he focuses on it a good amount, but I think he could do even more with it, and I'm going to expand it. And that is the positive benefits to you of not lying, the positive benefits to your friends or to the gaining of your friends or the type of friends that you want, but also what it does internally to help you become the best person that you can become. And there's an interesting way that he looks at this, and this is that much of who you are is nascent. And he gives some neurological background to this, which I'll read in a little bit. And he has a very interesting conception. I think it comes from Jung and Freud that I don't fully agree with, this idea that you are a literally, he makes it seem like you're a different human being in 5 years than you are today. Like Kirk in 5 years, or 35-year-old Kirk is fundamentally different than 32-year-old Kirk. And like a different human being. It's almost like 35-year-old Kirk is really Clark. And it's like, you know, that's how he makes it sound. And I don't agree with that. I think that's wrong way of looking at it. But I do agree with the idea that you become a better person, you become, or a worse person if you're not careful, and that your character does change such that you can look very different in a lot of ways and you can go down bad paths. So as Peterson points out in his first section on Tell the Truth, or At Least Don't Lie, it's Truth in No Man's Land. And the story he tells is he and a group of early psychologists, they're just training to be psychologists, are at a, basically, you know, to keep things simple, an insane asylum. Now, this is after it became illegal to have insane asylums, and the only people that were in these types of quote-unquote hospitals were extreme cases. And there were a group of him and seven other psychologists or trainees, and they were by a, I think a soda machine, just kind of waiting around. And this, you know, woman, this inpatient there, again, remember, they're very severe cases that if they stay at these hospitals, this woman came up to them and asked very quaintly, very quietly, very calmly, "Can I join you?" And now Peterson had several different options he could make. He could lie to her and say, you know, "No, you can't, because there's eight of us and we can only have eight people in our group, unfortunately." Or, "No, we can't. We're going to be leaving in just a few minutes, so unfortunately you cannot join us because you can't leave," right? But what he decided is to tell the truth. And he said, he looked at her and he said, "You cannot join us. We are," and I'm paraphrasing what he said, "we are psychologists and you are a patient. So that's why you can't join this group of psychologists." And so what that did was that stressed the fact that she was different than them. But Peterson at that point said that he understood how there are unknown, unseen, unknowable consequences to telling a lie. And so, you know, this is the first story that he comes up with, is tell the truth or at least don't lie. And the point is that telling the truth rather than lying is a pathway of life. It's not just a one-off incident like with this person. It was that he had already established in his career, in his mind, that he was always going to tell the truth, even if it hurt someone's feelings. And he tells another story about a biker in the next section in this chapter, which is called My Landlord. And he has this very scary biker president, you know, who is the landlord. And once on a regular basis, he will come over at 2 a.m. and knock on their door, trying to sell them a toaster or something so that he can make enough money to go get some more alcohol. Well, Peterson would usually oblige and do this, but his wife, Peterson's wife, started saying, "No, it's not good for you and it's not good for him." It made her nervous, and she didn't think it was good for Dennis, who she liked, Dennis, the landlord, and so did Peterson. And by helping him, he wasn't, you know, by helping him by giving him money, Dennis money, it wasn't helping Dennis. So Peterson was now in this weird situation where he was going to have to stand up to a drunken biker. And so he did it. When the biker came knocking at the door, 2 a.m., Peterson came over and Dennis, the biker, asked if he could, you know, sell, if he wanted to buy his toaster or some appliance. And Peterson had practiced with this, and he looked at the person and he looked at Dennis and he said, with no malice, no contempt, nothing, he said, I don't want any toasters right now. I don't need a toaster. And Dennis looked at him, realized that he was you know, pushing the bounds, and he could have beaten up Peterson for sure, but decided that there was no contempt in his face. He wasn't doing it with derision. He wasn't, you know, denying him to kind of show his status in life. He was just firmly and simply saying no. And Dennis respected that. And that's it. He went away and he never came back to ask to sell more toasters. So the point is that Peterson chose to pursue the path of truthfulness and to always pursue it. And as you'll see, it's really hard to make that a policy. That is something that is very challenging for people to do. And, you know, if you don't think it's challenging to do, that's going to be one of the themes that we're going to talk about. If you don't think it's a challenge, then I don't think you're taking honesty, truthfulness very seriously, because it is definitely very, very hard to be honest with yourself, with the world, because honesty is not so simple as not telling your wife that she looks fat in those jeans. That's a simplistic understanding of it. I think there's more that Peterson can do with his rule, and so I'm going to help him out. And the book that I'm going to be referring to kind of help out with the positive benefits of becoming a better you and going down the pathway of truthfulness, down the road of truthfulness rather than deceit. And they are roads. You can, you know, one little lie puts you on that path of deceit, and then you have to tell another lie and another lie. And before you know it, you don't even know that you're lying anymore. It becomes almost impossible to distinguish, because lying or not telling the truth is more than just not telling how you feel in a given minute. It's not understanding your approach to reality. Now, the book that I'm going to be talking about is Creativity, Inc., Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration by Ed Catmull. Now, this is the book. Ed Catmull is the founder, or one of the founders of Pixar, and the president. He's been the president of Pixar for 30 years or something like that. I don't know if he still is the president. He was when he wrote this book a few years ago. This is one of my favorite business books, because I think in business, more than anything, honesty pays. Literally. It definitely pays in real life for your own soul, for becoming the better person that you can become. But it certainly pays in the billions if you are honest. And Pixar, and the challenge with the business, though, is that it's one thing to be honest in your own soul by yourself. But the question is, how, when relating to other people, can you be honest with other people and have them be honest with you? So, for instance, it's really hard. Let me just give you a personal example. It's really, really, really hard to get people to honestly give you feedback on things like podcasts and books, you know, like, or articles that you write. It's really hard, you know, and I always am so grateful when I find someone who can give me honest feedback. And, you know, even the question of like, do I have any talent at all in writing? And that's one of the really challenging questions to get answered. You have to kind of see it for yourself, but it's helpful to get feedback from people, but it's very difficult to get honest feedback from people. Many people don't want to give you the honest feedback, or they don't know how to, or they don't feel comfortable doing it. And this is true if you try to ask people about you as a person. You know, why am I single? Why do I keep dating guys or girls that are bad for me? Why do this thing keep happening to me? Why do I keep getting fired? And then, you know, are the people around you established and well-trained by you enough to be honest with you? I mean, that's a challenging thing, to make your family, to make your friends, to make the guy at the bar, the girl at the bar that you talk to every Thursday afternoon, to make them, you know, comfortable enough and trained. I mean, I really think of it as you have to train people to be truly honest with you about you. That's hard. And Ed Catmull did it at Pixar. That's why Pixar is a friggin' hit machine. Is because they are extremely, extremely honest with each other and candid. And they've institutionalized candor and honesty. So let me tell you a little story from the book that I think you'll like. And it's a story I call Pixar's Billion Dollar Brain. And it's about, you know, the lesson in the story, I'm going to tell you ahead of time, is institutionalizing candor and honesty. It's one of the things that Pixar does better than probably any company on the planet. And it's something, whether you're a creative person or whether you're talking about for yourself, or whether you're talking about for your family, this rule in how to create a better, you know, environment for being candid and honest with each other will benefit you. It will help you so that you won't be so inclined to eat that candy bar because you're honest with people and there, and you've trained them to be honest with you to tell you, you shouldn't be doing that. That's not helpful for your diet, which you've said that you're on. The same thing with work ethic, the same thing with everything that you do. So this is a very important thing that you need to be, I think, applying. Okay, so after the mega success of Toy Story, the Pixar team encountered a problem many companies encounter: maintaining that secret sauce that had made them a success amidst an influx of outside influences. This is a big issue with a lot of companies. You know, after their success was established, Pixar started hiring a cadre of new and talented people. Now, where initially with Pixar, everyone on the team had worked for decades together, or for a decade together, years at the very least, and they felt comfortable expressing their criticisms about their films. Now, there were new people who had to gain that familiarity quickly. Prior to Pixar's expansion, the core group of animators, for instance, had been like a fraternity, able to offer harsh criticisms without becoming hostile or, worse, embittered. With new people came that uncomfortable feeling of offending people. Once, when Ed Catmull, who's the president of Pixar, as I said, witnessed a low-level computer designer who was too shy and unwilling to criticize a director whose latest film brought in $300 million. So Ed Catmull knew something had to change. I mean, think about that for a second, by the way. You're a low-level, you know, computer designer. You're invited into this pre-screening room with the director of a major film. And the film just grossed $300 million not too long ago. And now you're talking about a new film he's doing. And you, as this, you know, new low-level computer designer, are going to be intensely intimidated, to be honest with that person. So the question for a manager is, how can I institutionalize candor and honesty? So for it was this candid criticism, even when it became heated, that had led to the $300 million film in the first place. So to solve this problem, Ed institutionalized candor and honesty by creating what he dubbed brain trusts for each film. Now, this had to be handled delicately. Knowing that people are resistant to authority, he assured everyone that a brain trust had no authority whatsoever. It could merely make suggestions, and it was up to the artists to decide whether or not to implement any changes at all. The sole purpose of the brain trust was to provide a pulse for the director to gain intelligent feedback. You know, as I said, that's important for a writer, a creator, but it's also important for you as a person to, you know, if you're struggling with the idea of if you're on the right career path or if you're dating the right type of person, you should always be the final arbiter of that decision. But there is nothing wrong with getting feedback from other people because they may have a different perspective on the reality of the situation, which can help you make a better decision. So you need to institutionalize this into your soul, into your friendships, into everything. This is have brain trust, which again takes training. So again, the sole purpose of the brain trust is to provide a pulse for the director to gain intelligent feedback. Its purpose was to promote a spirit of debate among all the departments. This is something I do not see very often in businesses. There's just not a spirit of debate. And this, I think, is especially with small businesses, I think it's seen as a negative to, you know, criticize an idea or to debate something or to hash it out with what may feel like from the outside or from the inside, harsh discussion about an idea. Okay, so that's the point of a brain trust, is to promote a spirit of debate. This would inform the production team about the inevitable and, most importantly, the invisible flaws in all projects. Now, once Toy Story 2 was released, the productions began to expand at an unprecedented rate. You know, you had Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, and Incredibles all simultaneously being produced in this brand new, basically, production company. Brad Bird, who you might have heard of because he just did Incredibles 2 again. So Brad Bird, a director hired from outside the original core Pixar team, was to direct The Incredibles. So we're going to talk about the first Incredibles here. There, in directing The Incredibles, he got his first taste of institutionalized honesty and candor. While at first it was bitter for him, he eventually grew to love it. He loved it because it saved his film from disaster. At one point in the movie, The Incredibles, Helen and Bob, Elastigirl and Mr. Incredible, are arguing. Bob is not supposed to be going out to do superhero work like he did in his youth. So after returning home from gallivanting one night, he sneaks back into the house, but is caught by his wife, Helen. Now, the Brain Trust watched this scene and told Brad that the ensuing argument felt all wrong. They said it felt as though Bob was berating her too much. He was bullying her. It even felt a little too much like domestic abuse. Everyone who watched that scene in the Brain Trust informed Brad that they did not like Bob's character. Now, Brad had pitched the tone of the film and everyone had agreed to it. So he believed that in this situation, this is exactly how Bob, the character, Mr. Incredible, would react given who he was as a character. Now, fortunately, Brad was wise enough to understand that something was wrong if everyone reacted this way. So even though Brad didn't want to face the truth, all these people giving him feedback at least made him think, well, there's something that I'm missing. Then suddenly it hit him. Bob was so much physically larger than Helen. He was like a big, scary bear, and she was a petite little girl being threatened. This was the reason the Brain Trust had reacted the way they did. To solve the problem, Brad simply had Helen, Elastigirl, and her superpower is elasticity. He had her stretch and expand in size when she is holding her ground opposite her husband. During her line, for instance, "This is not about you." Elastigirl grows so large and so big that she dwarfs Bob. At the next Brain Trust meeting, everyone said it was an amazing sequence. They asked what lines had been altered, to which Brad replied, "None." Now, the Brain Trust had incorrectly identified the issue. They had thought it was because the dialogue and that Bob was verbally abusing her, that there was something wrong with this scene. But rather, Brad realized that their reaction was simply a signal that something needed to be altered. And the result was a $631 million box office mega hit. So one of the things that's interesting about watching Peterson is how he is really honest in a way that often gets him in trouble. So, for instance, he did an interview with Vox that has been continuously taken out of context, where he talks about this idea that Perhaps because it's so new, and by new he means in the scope of human history, hundreds of thousands of years, it's very new that we are working in relation to women in the way that we are in modern Western worlds. So in modern Western worlds, you know, you have men and women working equally next to each other, and that causes problems. And what he's, you know, the Vox person really jumped on this, and they edited the video in such a way as to make Peterson look like he was trying to say women shouldn't work in the workplace. That's not what he was saying at all. If you watch the whole interview, what he was saying was that it's just new and it's complicated and we don't know the rules. You know, for instance, why is it that women wear makeup in an office environment? And that's a serious question. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but if you're going to wear makeup, makeup implies a, you know, and I know not all women are going to agree with this, but there is an indication in some level that, you know, it's the same thing with like wearing sexy clothes. Like, why are you wearing skin tight jeans and a low cut dress to work? I mean, just imagine or open toed shoes. I mean, just imagine if like Larry came to the work with sandals on or something like that. Like, people would be like, you know, you don't wear that. Like, men still generally wear, you know, jeans. You know, if you're in Texas, you got jeans, boots, and a button down shirt. Or generally speaking, in most offices, you're wearing some kind of business casual. There's a very, you know, for men, that's very standard, basic, you know, equipment, basically. For women, there's more of a sexual connotation. Now, they can wear the kind of 1980s business suits, but they don't do that anymore. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. The point that Peterson was making is that women are wearing makeup, which suggests a kind of sexual overtone or undertone, I should say. There is a kind of like, you know, I'm making myself look prettier. Why? Well, because I want to look prettier. Why? So you can date somebody. I mean, if you don't care what you look like, or if you don't care about dating, you don't care what you look like. Now, what he was trying to say is that there's, you know, like red lipstick definitely has sexual tones to it. It's biological. It's psychological. It just does. It's why women have always had red lipstick. It's a big part of it. It reminds, you know, it's like it basically it, Peterson's discussion or explanation of it, and Peterson's a psychologist and a neuro, you know, he studied neurology, and you know, his explanation is that as apes, we have, you know, developed to react to color because of fruit. So fruit is actually the reason we can see the colors in the way that we can, because we need to see what fruits are ripe and which ones are rotten, because we, you know, as monkeys or as apes, we would eat fruits. And the red fruit, of course, has always been very powerful in our imagery. And it's, you know, related to food, to nourishment. And that is one of the reasons why women use red makeup or red lipstick, is it kind of makes, you know, turns on a guy's nourishment feeling. It's attractive, bright color that he looks at and he focuses on, and it's become a kind of sexual icon. And so if a woman doesn't want that to happen, where she turns a man on, why is she wearing makeup? Now, the way this was portrayed by other people outside of, you know, Peterson's cadre of followers, is that he wanted women out of the workroom, or he wanted them in like burkas, which is ludicrous. Again, it's ludicrous. He was simply asking the question honestly, because he didn't have an answer, and neither did the person. He was actually asking the person, like, what do we do in that situation? We have men who have a very standard uniform that's non-sexual. It's very routine. There's a reason the suit has, you know, kind of evolved the way that it does. And even though it's kind of evolved, it's changing a little bit now, which is great. And it's a little bit more business casual. There's still, you don't wear open-toed shoes as a man in your business or place of business. That would be so weird for most people. If you walked into, you know, Chase, if you worked at Chase Bank and you walked in as a teller with, you know, Birkenstocks on, people would be like, what are you doing, dude? Go home and get some socks on, fool. But women can do it all the time. Like, it's okay for women to have open toed shoes. I'm perfectly fine with women looking sexy, but that's beside the point. The point here is that Peterson was asking the question and, you know, going through the process of thinking. And this is what, and I think what makes Peterson so compelling is that he looks like the honest person in progress. He's always assessing and thinking, and this often gets him in trouble. And I think that's part of what, you know, is a challenge for him, is he's trying to, you know, just ask the question. He doesn't know the answer to why women are doing that and what should be done about it. What kind of rules could happen? Because the thing that women are outcrying against is any form of sexual harassment, even looking too long. Well, it's like, if you don't want guys to look, like, what are they supposed to, what am I supposed to do when a girl's wearing open-toed shoes, sexy, you know, pants, skin-tight pants, she's got all this makeup on, her hair's done, and she's got a low-cut dress. I'm like, and she's at work, and I'm bored or something. I look over, and there's this hot-ass chick. I mean, it's really hard to, like, not look at all, right? And, you know, the point is not, I, you know, not that sexual harassment is okay. I know that's how people will take it. The point is simply that, what do you do? Well, how do you fix that kind of thing? Because there are certain natural inclinations that men have that's hard. And what are they supposed to do? No pun intended. I mean, again, what are they supposed to do? So, you know, what are the rules? Should women, you know, just wear 1980s style, you know, women's suits or power suits or something like that? You know, that's, I don't know. There's dress codes for men. So why can't the dress codes from women just be a little bit less low cut shirts? That would be a tragedy to me, but you know, if a woman doesn't want me or anybody ever looking at them, then, you know, don't put pie out on the windowsill if you don't want people smelling and looking over at that tasty pie. All right. It's pretty simple. Anyway, so Peterson gets in trouble because he's always honest. That's the real point of that statement, of that little, you know, side issue there. Now, honesty can have these unintended consequences, and they can, there can be negative side effects to being honest. You can lose friends if you're honest. You can get fired if you're honest. And, you know, I think the principle is minimal honesty, minimal necessary honesty, I think is a good principle. You don't have to always tell everything or too much. And in fact, that is Peterson's next section. So the first two sections in this chapter or in this rule are truth in no man's land. And that's about the story of the insane asylum and the woman there and telling the truth, even though you're in this kind of weird, what he called no man's land, where how do you, you know, social rules of honesty don't really apply in an insane asylum. So how do you do it? You know, how do you think about it? And again, the principle is just all, when you don't know what to do, be honest, period. Tell the truth. And then the second one is, you know, my landlord, which is about the biker. Now, one of the things that he points out that I think is very beneficial is that, like I was saying with the biker, he could have, Peterson could have talked down to him, in which case the biker might have been pissed off about that. Or he could have said, no, I don't want your damn toaster. Or, no, I don't want your toaster. Or, no, I don't want your toaster, man. Stop getting drunk around me or something. You know, he could have had some kind of highfalutin view of, I'm Jordan Peterson getting my PhD and you're just a stupid biker. He could have had that tone and, you know, put that into his words that would have been a kind of a lie or a kind of way of lying, as Peterson puts it, where you're manipulating the world with the words you're using. And that's the next section, is manipulating the world. And it's about using words and reason and your rationalizing mind to change the world either for the better or for the worse. And he says, of course, as I hope you would realize, that you would choose also is choosing it for the better. But to do that, you really have to understand how you could choose it for the worst. So he starts off this chapter amazingly by telling you a series of what he calls calculated ends, E-N-D-S. And these are, you know, he calls these life lies, or Sigmund Freud called them life lies. Now, I think there's a lot of truth to this. And this is when you're talking, and this is true, you know, when you study body language or when you just go to a bar, and I just recommend doing this sometimes, go to a bar by yourself and don't bring a book and don't bring your phone and kind of wimp out and not really do what I'm about to tell you. Go to a bar, sit back and chill and start watching people. Just really watch people, because it is amazing how often people will reveal their true intentions through the words that they use. You know, if a guy and a, you know, I've used this example on the podcast before, but if a guy and a girl are sitting together and the guy is telling her about, you know, his job, the trips that he has to go on, and so on and so forth, he's actually telling her about, you know, the kind of lifestyle he lives, how much money he makes, the time off he gets in order to have more vacations, you know, which, you know, she might tell him about the book she's reading, the career she's pursuing, to kind of tell him subtly between the lines that she's very intelligent, well-read, that she is ambitious and she cares about her own career. And she might also subtly hint at certain sexual things, you know, to kind of hint at her sexual prowess and abilities. And so what I'm saying is everything we say when we're in speech mode with other people, there are some subtle reading between the lines. Peterson says that there are ill-formed desires, and being honest with yourself about those desires is really important. So pretending that you don't, like, it's a very, you know, on point that we're talking about kind of ideas, pretending you don't want to sleep with the woman that you're talking to while you're talking to her. Now, I'm not saying you should say out loud to her, you know, I want to sleep with you. That's not a good strategy. But, you know, pretending that you don't want to, when you really do, puts you at a weird loggerheads with your own desires and your own goals. And it will make the speech you have be very odd. And it's the same thing with, you know, your career or your friends. Like if you're pretending to like a friend that you don't really like, that's not good, man. Don't do that. If you don't like a friend, you should, you know, you don't have to say, I hate your guts, get the fuck out of my face. That's not a healthy way to work in the world. But you should separate yourself from that friend and you should be honest with yourself. You know, hey man, you're getting drunk again. I need you to go. And that's it. And then, you know, when they call again, say, no man, you get drunk too much. I'm sorry. I can't be around you anymore. I don't really see how valuable you are to my life. And I don't see how I can help you. You know, if you stop getting drunk, then we can hang out again. I'm more than happy. But so far, you're not doing good. And that is telling the truth, and it's a really harsh truth to tell. So here's a series of what he called typical calculated ends. And they might include, quote, to impose my ideological beliefs. So I when I'm talking to you, what I'm really doing is I'm not trying to be honest with you or to have a connection with you. I'm just simply trying to impose my ideological beliefs or to prove that I am or was right. I mean, that's a big one, right? We all know that one is that, and I get into that all the time. I just got into that today on Facebook, you know, on global warming or something like that. And I put something that I just shared a video that had to do, it was John Stossel. John Stossel is a very legitimate, you know, world-renowned and award-winning journalist. And he did an article not against global warming. It was not against global warming. It was simply saying that he was simply interviewing a guy who, you know, an author for a think tank, I think it was, who was saying that the Paris Accord that Trump just left, who took America out of the Paris Accord, that the Trump Accord was basically a fraud. And it was a fraud because, you know, it was basically they got all these countries together. They said, you know, they put a random statement that had nothing to do with what they were actually going to do or didn't even change anything about what they would be doing. And then they stapled it together and called it the Paris Accord. And so they gave a couple quotes in it in the video, and it said something like, you know, India was going to be, you know, it was just some very broad statement that basically meant nothing would change and India would do nothing differently than it was already planning to do. And China did the same thing in Afghanistan and all the countries in the Paris Accord. Basically, what their statements in the accord amounted to was we're going, you know, in just very flowery, fancy, bureaucratic language that nobody can understand what the hell they're saying. But it was basically saying, we're going to do what we were going to do anyway. That's it. And the only one country that did not do that was America. America made legitimate, like they were going to cut off a third this is under Obama, of our emissions. And Trump said, no, this is a farce. If you're not going to do anything, I'm not going to do anything. Our country not going to do anything. And the last point that the video made was that, hey, we have this, you know, even if America ceased outputs 100%, it wouldn't change anything about global warming. Because the issue with global warming was the main issue that's happening with global warming at this point is the increases that are happening in the rest of the world, in China and India in particular, where you have a billion people in each country and they're rapidly expanding. So anyway, the point is that I got in this argument on Facebook and I shouldn't have done it. And, you know, it's just a back and forth about this. The person was talking about some random ideas about, you know, global warming and how it's bad. And, you know, I was like, I don't think you're listening to the video. It has nothing to do with it. So the point is that there are certain, you know, to prove that you're right is a very seductive and common way of interacting with the world. And, you know, another one is to appear competent. I think that's what my opponent was doing. He was, because what he would do is he would, you know, quote a whole bunch of people. He would throw out, you know, he would go, I could see him Googling stuff, finding a Forbes article. Maybe he had already read the Forbes article and then he threw it on there. I mean, he threw like within a 5 minute thing, like three or four different articles. And then, and I'm probably exaggerating, but he threw a couple of articles at least. He threw some graphs and some, and then a whole bunch of stats. And I'm like supposed to go through all this and figure out what the hell he's talking about. And that was his argument. But the point is that he was trying to appear competent. And maybe he was somewhat competent. I didn't argue that I was competent. I didn't know what I was talking about. I just shared a damn video that talked about the Paris Accord. It was nothing against global warming. My point is simply that in every interaction, online or offline, we have these calculated ends. And the important thing is to be aware of them. And it's really hard to be aware of them in yourself. You know, I started seeing that I was, you know, perhaps not reading his whole thing. And so I admitted it. I said, dude, I'm not going to read all of this stuff. I'm just not. You know, like, it's too much stuff. I just shared this damn thing. I'm not trying to become an expert right now. And all the, you know, I'm not going to become a climate scientist right now. Like, that's crazy. And so I told him that. And that was how I was trying to be honest, because I realized that by responding and not saying that, I wasn't being fully honest, and he was responding with these long soliloquies or missives on his view. So another life lie is to ratchet myself up the dominance hierarchy. That could be to cut someone down, you know, or to make yourself look bigger than you are. I used to see this all the time in Los Angeles, you know, or even Orange County. You know, it's where guys will start talking about their cars is a big one. There's nothing wrong with having a nice car, but it's, you know, I've actually seen guys who had a BMW and lived in a shit apartment. I thought that was just incredible. You know, with like three roommates. Like, what the hell do you have a BMW, dude? What are you doing? Anyway, you know, to avoid responsibility is another one. To garner credit for others' actions. Here's some more life lies. To be promoted. To attract the lion's share of attention. To ensure that everyone likes me, or to garner the benefits of martyrdom, to justify my cynicism. I have a friend, he may listen to this, I won't say his name, but he definitely, when he talks, he uses only words that justify his cynicism. He can come up with the most asinine discussion, you know, it doesn't matter what we're talking about, somehow it proves that there's no such thing as goodness and virtue in the world. To rationalize my antisocial outlook. I do that one sometimes. I got to be careful with that one. To minimize immediate conflict. I definitely do not do that one. To maintain my naivete. To capitalize on my vulnerability. To always appear as the sainted one. I might do that occasionally. Or this one is particularly evil. To ensure that it is always my unloved child's fault. So those are what Peterson called life lies. And, you know, it's important to understand where you're coming from, because a life lived in this manner is based consciously or unconsciously on two premises, as Peterson puts it. The first is the current, that current knowledge is sufficient to define what is good, unquestioningly far into the future. And the second is that reality would be unbearable if left to its own devices. Now, this is where he gets, you know, so much like Rand. This is why I'm always telling people, like, there's so much about him that's like Ayn Rand, or at least there's some things. Because he is saying that if you live these life lies, or if you have these calculated ends, one of the great danger, or what you're trying to do psychologically, is you're saying to yourself that reality is unbearable and I have to do something about it, which is to lie, basically. And, you know, what he goes on to say is the first presumption is philosophically unjustifiable. What you are currently doing might be an error. The second is even worse. And I agree. This is, Ayn Rand would agree that the second one, which is that reality would be unbearable if left to its own devices. So I need to lie. I need to manipulate. I need to make this girl think that I'm a rich person, that I'm wealthy, or that I'm, you know, I have a lot of friends, or that I'm powerful, or that I have whatever going on for me. You know, that is more evil because you're saying that reality is unbearable. And it is valid only if reality is intrinsically intolerable and simultaneously something that can be successfully manipulated and distorted. But it cannot. It cannot be manipulated. It cannot be distorted. Now, he'll go on to talk about what I see as a 32, I'll be 33 very soon, as in a week. So if you want to do me, if you want to have my birthday be really great, then please share this podcast for my present. Share it all over the place. but, you know, what he is going to be talking about now is something that I've realized in my 32 years more and more. I see it all the time. It's one of the great tragedies of modern living, I think. And it's, you know, there's two things. One, not trying new things and thinking about new ideas in a way that will challenge you. And two, it's a stubborn, you know, a concomitantly on the same coin, it's a stubborn pursuit of goals that you have been shown by evidence, lots of evidence, is not the appropriate goal at the moment or in the way that you're pursuing it. And yet the person will not surrender or transform or change the goal and their outcome. You know, and we'll talk about what's called in Pixar, I'm going to talk about Ed Catmull's goal and how that changed over the course of, you know, 24 years or something like that. And then how it changed again over the next 20 years. And I'll talk about, or now I'm going to read the poem by Margaret Sangster, The Sin of Omission, because that's what Peterson talks about in this goal, is there are two types of sins. There's a sin of commission, or commission, which is to do something you know to be wrong, and everyone knows that that's not good. But a sin of omission is you let something bad happen when you could do something to stop it. And this is, in his view and in my view, worse. So one example that he gives is, you know, think about an 18-year-old who says that I'm going to retire at 40, right? I'm going to be financially or just retire. I'm not going to work anymore at 40. It's a naive child view of things. You know, I'm going to live on an island or something like that when I'm 40. And that's such a silly way of looking at life because, you know, that's what Peterson puts it brilliantly. I love it. He calls that's a travel poster, not a plan for life. Because when you get on that island, sure, you have the first couple margaritas. That's going to be great for the first couple of days, maybe even a couple of weeks, maybe even months. But after a year, you're going to be 41. That's it. You're still young as hell. And you're going to be bored out of your gourd. So you're going to have to do something for productivity, or hopefully something for productivity. So that's a really bad, that's a sin of omission. It's not to ask the question, what next? Then what? So here's this poem, very simple, very, I think it's a cutesy little poem, not a deep, you know, William Blake or William Shakespeare poem, but it's a great, it's a good little poem I like. And it's called, and the reason I chose it, because it's simply called The Sin of Omission. It isn't the thing you do, it's the thing you leave undone, which gives you a bit of heartache and the set at the setting of the sun. The tender word forgotten, the letter you did not write, The flower you might have sent are your hunting ghosts tonight. The stone you might have lifted out of a brother's way. The bit of a hearthsome counsel you were hurried too much to say. The loving touch of the hand, the gentle and winsome tone that you had no time or thought for with troubles enough of your own. The little acts of kindness, so easily out of mind. Those chances to be helpful, which everyone may find. No, it's not the thing you do. It's the thing you leave undone, which gives you the bit of heartache at the setting of the sun. So Margaret is saying, I think very simply and cutely, that at the end of the day, it's not the things you do that are going to give you a bit of heartache. Although I think it can have that too, but this is a very specific poem about the sin of omission. She's trying to tell you about the things you don't do. So it isn't the thing you do, it's the thing you leave undone. So for instance, she gives a whole bunch of examples. The tender word forgotten. You leave home in the morning, 7 a.m. to go to work, and you say gruffly to your wife, bye. Or you don't even say anything at all. You just go out the door like a 16-year-old boy. The letter you did not write. You received a gift when you got to work. You saw that someone had sent you a gift for your birthday. And you get it. It's a fruitcake, and you eat it, and you're done. That's it. You didn't write it. So then the flower you might have sent. So you could have sent her a flower. You could have apologized to your wife for not saying a tender word when you left, but you didn't. The flower you might have sent. Those are going to be your haunting ghosts tonight. The next stanza. The stone you might have lifted out of a brother's way. So you could have made something a little bit easier for a friend, for your brother, your little brother, or maybe just somebody on the street. Maybe you could have, someone was clearly in a hurry and you're not. So maybe you could have let them go ahead of you in line for the coffee. Just something simple like that. The bit of heartsome counsel you were hurried too much to say. Again, simply, you could be, have a young person who's in your care at work or something. I'm using work as an example, but it's true. I mean, there's a lot of things that you could be doing. Is you see that your kids are having trouble at school, but you're too busy to help them. You're too busy to sit down, to listen to them, and to give them some good advice. The loving hand, the loving touch of the hand, the gentle and winsome tone. So again, you're so hurried, you omit, you forget, you don't do these things. The little acts of kindness so easily out of mind, those chances to be helpful, which everyone may find. So what Margaret Sangster, I think, is saying is simply that there are definitely things that you can omit that are problems, and they're just as big of problems, if not more, than the sin of commission. Now, think of Pollyanna. This can have effects that are not just you feel bad about them, as in the Sangster poem, but it can have effects that are a ripple effect that could destroy your whole life. And Peterson makes this example, makes that argument. So here's one example: is consider the Pollyanna who fakes it to get along, right? Like Peterson's favorite example, Solzhenitsyn. Solzhenitsyn followed Rule 5, which is to socialize your child, and Solzhenitsyn was very socialized. Okay, so he wanted to get along, and sometimes that means faking it when people are starting to talk negatively about the gypsies and positively about this communist thing. And, Solzhenitsyn just doesn't speak up because you're supposed to be socialized. You're supposed to be a good boy. So he does it. He never challenges the authority or speaks out. And thus he's taken advantage of, or in the case of Solzhenitsyn, he's thrown in a gulag. But if you're a Pollyanna, meaning you see only good things and you never, it's like, oh, everything's so honky-dory, even though you're like on a river boat, or you're on a raft on a river, and it's about to go over a waterfall, and you think, oh, everything's so great. Yeah. but if that person is in real life, if they're a Pollyanna, they're never challenging authority at work. they're not willing to do that. They never would speak out. They don't, they, and thus they're taken advantage of. They, you know, since she doesn't speak her mind, she's also not capable of connecting with anybody, because you can't connect with someone if you don't speak your honest truth. If you say, you know, if they say, oh, I love, you know, Beyonce music, and you're like, oh, I don't like her at all, but you don't say that because you're afraid to not connect. Well, the problem is, if you don't do that, you can never connect on anything, because you're constantly putting a barrier between you and your friends and the people around you. So the Pollyanna, who's not honest all the time, actually ends up more lonely, even if she's surrounded by people, because again, she has nobody that she can talk to about how she feels inside, you know, internally. So I wanted to tell you a couple more Pixar stories. I mean, again, this book, Creativity Inc., is incredible, whether you're a business person or not. It has just so many incredible stories that are relevant to this idea of honesty and candor, because the whole point of the book is what Ed Catmull realized was this pattern of success to failure. He saw it over and over and over again. So Catmull, just so you know, he had the dream of having, or of creating the first feature length film done completely on a computer in the mid 70s. He had this dream. So, and he didn't accomplish it along with John Lasseter until 1995 with Toy Story. So, you know, almost 20 years, like 15 years. It took him a long time. And that, you know, he did a lot of things, including Pixar was not originally an animation company. It was actually a computer computer hardware company. They sold very sophisticated computers, basically. And so Catmull got his start, and, you know, he worked for decade in Silicon Valley. He actually worked for Lucasfilm before he worked for Pixar, or I should say more accurately, Lucasfilm is the origins of Pixar, because Catmull worked for a department within Lucasfilm, but then, and the department was figuring out how to use computer graphics to enhance feature length film, like live action film. And this is when Catmull started getting his, you know, desires more concretely planned out, that he wanted to have the first feature length animated film, not on a computer. And so, but the problem was that Lucas went through a divorce, and he had to sell off a whole bunch of stuff to pay for it. One of the things that he ended up selling was this department of his company. So it ended up that he sold it to Steve Jobs. It would take a little while, but he sold it to Steve Jobs. And then that's where, you know, they start selling this computer imaging software. They were going to sell it to weather stations and things like that to do a very specific kind of imaging. But anyway, the point is that Catmull worked in Silicon Valley since the beginnings of Silicon Valley, for the most part. And he, you know, tells these stories in his book, Creativity Inc., about how he saw these high profile people succeed. And basically, you know, the pattern was always the same. They got this incredible, you know, success. They had somebody tell them, you know, somebody give them all this money, and they started making a lot of money, or at least it seemed like they were doing it. And they were heralded as the titans of the new, and they were, you know, they were confident. They radiated supreme confidence, as Ed Catmull put it. And surely they could only have reached this apex by being very, very good. But then those companies did something stupid, not just stupid in retrospect, but stupid obvious at the same time, at the time. So here's Catmull. I wanted to understand why. What was causing smart people to make decisions that sent their companies off the rails? I didn't doubt that they believed they were doing the right thing, but something was blinding them. So what interested me was not the companies that companies rose and fell, or that the landscape continually shifted as technology changed, but that the leaders of these companies seemed so focused on the competition that they never developed any deep introspection about their destructive forces that were at work. So he starts from this premise that, you know, Pixar, when he finally struggled and got to the point where he, you know, was able to make the kind of films that he wanted to, that the next challenge was not creating a first feature animated film done on a computer. The next challenge was making sure that what happened to all those companies in Silicon Valley that go so high and then they fall because they're blinded by their own arrogance, that or their own silliness or stupidity, that he wouldn't fall into that category and Pixar wouldn't fail as well. And that, I think, is an important, you know, very challenging thing to do. So I do want to tell you this story called Jerry's Game, Pixar's $2 million experiment. And this really showcases the kind of thinking that Pixar does. And I think you can learn from it, because the story is really about leaving the door open for the unexpected. Because if you do, in will walk in unforeseen values. And this is kind of the flip side to being truthful, to telling the truth, or at least not lying, is that, you know, when you go out there and you tell the truth and you're in this brain trust kind of idea, you might go after one view, but like we're saying with these people who hold on to their goals, even in the face of contrasting evidence, the problem is that you could be missing a lot of unforeseen values. And that is what this story really indicates. So in 1998, Pixar released a short 5-minute film along with the movie A Bug's Life. Now, from the perspective of the audience, this short was an enjoyable addition to the feature film. Internally, however, the shorts program was initiated to solve an important managerial problem. Now, the short was called Jerry's Game, and you can actually find it if you YouTube Jerry's Game Pixar short. You'll see the short little film. It features a genial old man sitting in a park playing chess against himself. Now, there's no dialogue besides the occasional ha when he has struck a solid move. The humor derives from the dual personality of the old man as he switches from one side of the table to the other, taking on a new, more diabolical personality. The director, Jan, was given free rein to do what he wanted. His only assignment was to use a human figure. Back in 1998, Pixar had not mastered the nuances of creating a quality human figure through computer graphics. Humans had always been ancillary to their films about toys, monsters, and bugs. The short program was initiated with the expectation that it would hasten technological innovations and provide training opportunities for new directors. These, however, turned out to be false expectations. Only one short film drove any real technological innovation, and it turned out that directing a short was helpful training, but vastly different than directing an hour and a half, $97 million feature-length film, budgeted film. There were, however, unintended, unknown, and unforeseen benefits of the program. For example, the employees who worked on Jerry's Game and the others gained a broader range of experiences because there were less people on the crew. This forced each crew member to do a variety of tasks, which never happens on a big budget film where specialization is king. The employees also forged deeper relationships with one another. The films themselves bonded moviegoers to the Pixar brand. And inside the company, people noticed that Pixar truly valued artistry, since they spent up to $2 million on these projects without directly receiving any money in return. Well, the Pixar management team had expected one set of benefits. They got another set completely. This proved their hypothesis, however. Leave the door open for the unexpected, and in will walk unforeseen values. So you may ask, what does this have to do with honesty and truthfulness? Well, The idea is that they went into these things with the knowledge that I may not know the values that I'm going to get out of it. So I'm going to invest $2 million into something, only hoping I'll get something out of it. That's a hell of a gamble, even for a mega corporation or company like Pixar. So the point is that you need to experiment. This is what Peterson is talking about when he talks about the nascent you. Here's how Peterson puts it. When you explore boldly, when you voluntarily confront the unknown, you gather information and build your renewed self out of that information. That is the conceptual element. However, researchers have recently discovered that new genes in the central nervous system turn themselves on when an organism is placed or places itself in a new situation. These genes code for new proteins. These proteins are the building blocks for new structures in the brain. This means that a lot of you is still nascent in the most physical of senses and will not be called forth by stasis. You have to say something, go somewhere, and do things to get turned on. And if not, you remain incomplete, and life is too hard for anyone incomplete. So the idea is, you know, in the sin of omission idea here, go out and explore. That's actually a part of truthfulness, he's saying. He's saying, tell the truth or at least don't lie. Part of that is to, you know, you have to explore new things to find out where the truth even is with you. You may not even know what the truth inside of you may be or how you may understand the world a little bit differently if you go try to become a, you know, artist. Maybe you've always been an engineer, so you should try being an artist. Or if you're an artist, you should try learning how to fix things. By learning how to fix things, if you've never done it or very rarely, you may learn new things about yourself and maybe you can apply that to your artistry. And so the point is that there's a lot of you that you don't know, that's invisible. This is an important element of truthfulness and honesty that we've been talking about, is that it's impossible to know it. And so you have to go out and explore, try, go into, you know, try jujitsu if you've never done it. Go lift weights if you've always run, stop running all the time and go lift weights. And I'm the opposite way. I go run once in a while and I hate it, but I do it. And, you know, but by doing it, you kind of develop a new you, is what Peterson's saying. And this is true of anything. If you're nervous around people, go to bars by yourself and make it a rule to talk to somebody or make it a goal. Just talk to one person to say hello, even if it's the bartender, which is a lot very easy to do. And then go again, you know, a couple weeks later, maybe to a new bar if you're too embarrassed. Just go to a random bar where nobody will know you, nobody will recognize you. Go in for one drink, say hello to the bartender, leave. And then a week later, go to another bar or the same one if you feel comfortable. Get one drink, say hello to the person next to you, ask them how they're doing, and leave. By doing that, if you've never done something like that, or if you've never done things like that, you will literally build a new you. Or I shouldn't say literally. Euron Brook is going to get mad at me. Not really, I'm just kidding. But yeah, there's... you are building, you're bringing out of you and becoming a new you. So being better isn't the right way of thinking about it. It's becoming, you're actually becoming a better person, a better you. In the incredible book, The Ominous Parallels, I just read that, reread that by Leonard Peikoff. There is a section called The Concentration Camps. And it's, you know, about what, the process and the purpose and the, you know, the big question that was going on implicitly in this weird little world that they had created, that the Nazis had created. And this is the negative side of lying, of course, of deceiving, of being, you know, of having resentment and vengefulness. It's that deceit produces the terrible suffering of mankind. You know, that's where we get, when you have deceit, it's where you get the death camps. And in the death camps, in these, you know, camps, it was, by the way, not just the prisoners who were destroyed. The soldiers, the guards that were there were also destroyed. You know, for the most part, after the initial men who created the camps, for the most part, the new guards and administrators were ordinary men, at least at the beginning. They did not particularly hate the prisoners or lust after blood. As a rule, they were more interested in time off than in another chance to inflict torture. Now, when the SS took over, the old spontaneous bestiality gave way to an absolutely cold and systematic destruction of human bodies, calculated to destroy human dignity. Death was avoided or postponed indefinitely. The camps were no longer amusement parks for beasts in human form, that is, for men who really belonged in mental institutions and prisons. The reverse became true. They were turned into drill grounds on which perfectly normal men were trained to be full-fledged members of the SS. So the big question was, what specifically did the camp rulers wage war on and seek to destroy in man? Now, what Peterson is saying, and he uses Milton's devil as an example. This creature in Milton, which I have not read Paradise Lost, so I don't know about it, but I know what Peterson is saying and arguing. I know enough about the character in Milton's Paradise Lost of the fallen angel is that he represented high rationalism, high quote unquote logic, although I wouldn't call it logic actually, but it is a form of, you know, rationalizing and the ability to rationalize. And one of the points that Peterson makes out is that one of the great temptations of being good at rationalizing, at coming up with reasons, not logical reasons. And by logical, I mean grounded in the facts of reality, grounded in the proper organization of the senses and how the senses hit your eyes, and you take the senses, the perceptions that you get out of the world, and you reason based on always connecting yourself to reality. Because one of the conclusions you have to come to is the idea of life-enhancing values versus death-enhancing values. And I think that is a logical statement, and anything against that is illogical. So I don't think that, you know, these death camp people were logical in any sense of the way. And I don't think that Milton's devil was logical. He was rational in the sense that he could come up with these brilliant rationalizations all up in the floating in the sky, disconnected from any kind of reality. And that I think he was able to do. But this is important, what Peterson is saying here. I do agree with this. It's very, very challenging not to succumb to this. And here's how Peterson puts it. I like it. Is the process of rationality can produce clarity and progress. But here's the side issue that is true. This is a true statement. It is because rationality is subject to the single worst temptation: to raise what it knows now to the status of an absolute. Now, I take truck with Peterson's view of absolutes. I think absolutes can be useful, and we need them sometimes to have some absolutes. But what he's trying to say that I think is very helpful is that it's what he calls a totalitarian certainty. So certainty is great. But the problem becomes when you become so enamored with an idea you have. Whether you came up with the idea, whether you read the idea, doesn't matter. Or even if it's a goal, you become so enamored with this idea or goal that you've come up with that you refuse to transform it, to budge on it, even in the face of counter evidence. And that's one of the reasons why Peterson is so anti-ideologue. And I understand what he's saying. You know, Ayn Rand called this the objectivists who were guilty of this church on Sunday objectivists. And Dr. Peikoff called them rationalist. We all succumb to this. This is so difficult not to succumb to. And if you're an objectivist listening to this, you have got to get the course Understanding Objectivism. It will shatter your thoughts that you are not doing this. Because the thing is that And this is why it's so good to think of this as a personality. You do, you know, just as a way of thinking about this, as a way of contemplating it, not as an actual literal truth, as Peterson would put it. But it's helpful to think of this as a devil that is rationalizing and that you don't have control over it if you don't challenge that devil. So if you're a Christian and Catholic, you need to take the best arguments and really think about if they're right, you know, and if you're an objectivist. I heard this the other day, Yaron Brook, one of my favorite objectivists, and one of the few times I've ever really adamantly disagreed with him. And it's when he was announcing that Jordan Peterson was going to be coming to the Objectivist Conference, a yearly conference. He was going to be coming to the conference, and he was going to be doing a panel with Dr. Ankar Gatte, who I love. Ankar Gatte, he was my teacher when I was in the Objectivist Academic Center for 4 years. There's going to be Dr. Brook, and there's going to be Dave Rubin and Dr. Peterson. They're going to be up there. I think it's going to be great. But the way that the thing that I really disagree with was the way that Yaron Brook approached talking about this on his show recently. And what he said was that, you know, even though he basically said over and over again that Peterson is wrong, Peterson is wrong, Peterson is wrong, Peterson is wrong. And, you know, great. I think there are things that Peterson is wrong about, but the focus shouldn't be how wrong Peterson is. It's how can I learn whatever I can from this person who's obviously smart. He obviously knows something. He's not a dummy. Nobody gets to the level that he does without being a dummy. So the question should be, how can I learn as much about his ideology and how he got successful so that I can learn what's going on with the culture better and how we can become better? And then, yeah, if I disagree with him, speak up. Like I've been saying in this podcast today, speak up, speak up, speak up. But the point is, I definitely didn't like how Brooke was focusing on the how wrong Peterson was. Even if Peterson ends up being wrong about everything, to me, that's not the approach you should always be taking. And especially, when you're inviting them over to your conference, the way that Yaron Brook put it was that we have, you know, whenever you're in a debate, you should not focus on convincing the person. You should focus on convincing their audience. And that's true. But I think that, you know, and I think it's a good thing I've learned that from Alex Epstein, and I've learned that from Yaron Brook. I think it's a great way of looking at debates. It doesn't make sense to try to actually convince the debaters. They're too focused on, you know, an audience and getting their ideas across. It's way more sensical to try to convince the audience. But here's the thing. This is, you're inviting him to your home. So it's different. You should try to convince his audience, you know, or to present the best case for your ideas that you can. But the opportunity is not merely growth. That's great. And that's focusing on, you know, people who may pay for Ocon in the future. The focus should be on helping the people in the audience and the objectivists see how they should interact with someone they disagree with and how they can learn from them. So in other words, it's to model a certain kind of inquisitive thinker. I think that is so much more powerful to learn from Dr. Jordan Peterson, his ideas, and then to think about them for yourself and you know, take them seriously and say, you know what, that's a great idea that I think I like. Or, you know, I like your idea of mythology because, you know, I don't think that it's a literal truth, but I think it is a great way to contemplate certain truths. And that's true. It's true that you can contemplate. This is Ayn Rand's theory of art, is that the whole point of literature is that it gives you, and art, is that it gives you a way to contemplate deep metaphysical and epistemological questions, and even ethical questions that is not so easy to contemplate and to chew when you're just talking about words, just like word salads. It's better when they're concrete, specific, with characters, with names, with personalities, with quirks and traits. That's so much more powerful. And that's where I think he's right. So I just want to make sure that that is, I hope that's something that will happen. And I know that, you know, Dr. Brook and Dr. Gatte are pros, so they're not going to like berate him or anything. But I just think the mentality could be better, that we can go in there with, hey, As an objectivist, I want to learn as much as I can from the most powerful or most successful intellectual of today. So I wanted to finish this episode, which for Peterson, his last section in this rule is the truth instead, where he talks about having an aim, but being willing to transform the aim. And that's, you know, and you can think of that as having a goal, a career passion, but being willing to change it. Because I see that happen so much where people refuse to change it until they're hit dead face, you know, with failure that is inescapable and they don't know what to do anymore and their life is in shambles. And I think that's a bad way of doing it. And I love Ed Catmull's focus on this and how he does this and how he's, you know, been able to change his focus and how, why he thinks about it well. So for instance, after, you know, again, think of his story. He started off in computer graphics in the, when the computer graphics were basically invented in the early 70s. And he loved Disney. He wanted to be an animator, but realized early on when he was a teenager, you know, he took some drawing classes and just realized that he did not probably have the talent to become an animator. But what he did realize was, one, that he loved science, and two, he understood at that time how to become a scientist. And that's not irrelevant to making your choices. So he didn't know how to become an animator, but he knew how to become a scientist. So he went after that. And so he got his PhD in, you know, computer graphics or computer science at a very, you know, the only one of the few colleges that does it. And that opened up so many doors for him. Then after 20 years of working toward the goal of creating the first feature-length animated film, he finally did it with Toy Story 1995. So he was thinking about this for decades. Now, the problem was, you know, they were busting out Bugs Life, Toy Story 2. Everything was, here's Ed Catmull, everything was going our way, and yet I felt adrift. This is being, you know, he felt something, and so he's going to be accurate and, you know, respond to that feeling. I felt adrift. In fulfilling a goal, I had lost some essential framework. Is this really what I want to do? I began asking myself. The doubts surprised and confused me, and I kept them to myself. I had served as Pixar's president for most of the company's existence. I loved the place and everything that it stood for. Still, I couldn't deny that achieving the goal that had defined my professional life had left me without one. Is this all there is? I wondered. Is it time for a new challenge? There was plenty, this is later on, there was plenty to occupy my working hours, but my internal sense of purpose, the thing that had led me to sleep on the floor of the computer lab in graduate school just to get more hours on the mainframe, that kept me awake at night as a kid, solving puzzles in my head, that fueled my every workday, had gone missing. I'd spent 2 decades building a train and laying its track. Now, the thought of merely driving it struck me as far less interesting task. Was making one film after another enough to engage me, I wondered? What would be my organizing principle now? It would take me a full year for the answer to emerge. So he's recognizing the truth that there is something missing and he doesn't know what it is. That is a truth. That is what it looks like to actually speak the truth in real life, is to say something is wrong, and it's to act and it's to like accept it and to think about it and to say, I'm going to figure the hell out what is wrong and what I don't understand about myself and why I'm now dissatisfied after I've finally accomplished my goal. In his search for figuring out what his new goal would be, he went back to that question that he saw in Silicon Valley that I had read to you earlier. He saw those successful Silicon companies, multi-million-dollar companies, bursting out of the earth like a titan from the ages of the age of bronze, but then all of a sudden they would crumble like stone. What was causing smart people to make decisions that sent their companies off the rails? That's what he was asking. And he was trying to figure that out. And then he started thinking, and this is after he had done Pixar and was trying to figure out his new purpose. He asked himself, can paying a careful attention to the missteps of others help us be more alert to our own missteps? Or is there something about becoming a leader that makes you blind to the things that threaten the well-being of your enterprise? So as I turned my attention from solving technical problems to engaging with the philosophy of sound management, I was excited again and sure that our second act could be as exhilarating as the first. So that's what this book is about. The book that the Creativity Inc. is about, you know, he spent another, you know, the Creativity Inc. was published in like 2015, I think. And so from 96 or 97 or 8 or so to 2015, 16, he was figuring out how to make sure that he could overcome the unseen forces that stand in the way of true inspiration so that they could have a hit machine, which they do. And by the way, what's really interesting is when he was tapped, him and John Lasseter were tapped to be the president of Disney Animation. This is after Disney Animation went through a lull. After Lion King, they went through this lull where they just failed after failed after failed. And he tried it again, and they then all of a sudden had Tangled, followed by Frozen, two mega hits. And I know that Peterson doesn't like Frozen, but I understand why, but that's beside the point I'm trying to make here. So here's how I'm going to end. It's how he ends his introduction. And I hope that you go read Ed Catmull's book. I know you've already read Peterson's book, otherwise why are you listening to me? So here's what Ed Catmull says. And he has now, remember, a new central mission. And it's to find those unseen forces that destroy companies. Because he didn't want Pixar to be destroyed. He wanted it to flourish. So he wanted to figure out, what are those unseen forces that stand in the way of true inspiration? And the key for me, what has kept me motivated in the 19 years since Toy Story debuted, has been the realization that identifying these destructive forces isn't merely a philosophical exercise. It is a crucial central mission. In the wake of our earliest success, Pixar needed its leaders to sit up and pay attention. And that need for vigilance never goes away. This book, then, is about the ongoing work of paying attention, of leading by being self-aware, as managers and as companies. It is an expression of the ideas that I believe make the best in us possible. Thank you.